Welcome, everyone. I'm Miriam Horn, author of Rancher Farmer Fisherman and the host of EDF Engage. We're glad you could join us today after a nerve-wracking week to talk about these midterms we've all just survived and what they mean for the issues we care about. Our guests today work with EDF Action, the advocacy partner of EDF, which engaged in this election cycle as never before. EDF Action spent nearly $9 million supporting environmental champions and working to defeat candidates who have sided with polluters. They put almost a quarter of that money into state and local races, a big increase from years past, to identify and support the next generation of conservation champions. They launched an academy to train these young candidates in running campaigns, and they found new ways to engage EDF members, including mobilizing them in the field for pro-environment candidates. All told, EDF Action's engagement in 35 races helped win at least 24 seats for environmental champions and defeat at least 5 climate science deniers. Today, we're fortunate to have two people who haven't slept in months but know more than almost anyone about what just happened and its implications for the environment. Joe Bonfilio, president of EDF Action, spent 15 years developing policy and political strategy for U.S. senators and congressmen. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Miriam.
And Linda Tran, a consultant to EDF, is a CBS News contributor and founding partner of 270 Strategies, which advises Democratic campaigns and progressive organizations. Thanks for joining us today, Linda.
Great to be with you.
We hope all of you will also be part of this conversation. If you want to ask a question, press star 1 to get online. If you change your mind, press pound to get offline. If you need the operator, press star 0. You can also email us questions at edfengage@edf.org. Linda, let's start with the big picture. What will it mean to again have a divided government and a presidential campaign that seems to already be underway? What kind of policies will be possible in this new landscape?
Well, honestly, Miriam, I think it's anyone's guess exactly what this new world order is going to result in. But in broad terms, I think we're looking at two essential pillars of change. So one is on the accountability front. Members of Congress on the Democratic side of the aisle have been very, very clear that they are going to be looking for greater transparency across a number of different fronts, especially as it pertains to this White House and its cabinet offices. That's certainly going to have an impact on a number of different issues as well. And who is likely going to be Speaker of the House again, Nancy Pelosi, has made clear that among these for the new Congress will be potentially working with the administration on an infrastructure deal, working on ways to reduce prescription drug pricing, and other potential issues where there are areas of agreement among Democrats and Republicans. But it's going to be a bit of a wild ride, and we're still seeing a lot of races that have been on the fence coming in even today, and that majority on the House side is continuing to grow. On the flip side, you've got a number of Democratic seats that were lost in the Senate and likely at least one other. And so there's going to be a strange kind of split government dynamic. At the state level as well, there were a lot of big changes that were not reported as much with the media over the last few days, but Democrats took 7 new governorships, and that's going to be a massive change, and flipped 7 of the state legislatures. Those changes are going to come into play when it comes to redistricting and drawing of the maps for the next cycle. And so I think that the repercussions from the last couple of days are going to be long-lasting and pretty extensive, but what we know from the Trump era is that none of the old rules apply, and on any given day, something might be driving priorities in Washington, D.C. that you might never have anticipated before that. That means opportunities and challenges in the future, and also will have implications on climate.
Oh, well, that's encouraging that climate might be one of those collaborative opportunities. Joe, let me turn to you and to just give us a bit more insight into how EDF Action actually engaged, where you were and what you did and who you partnered with.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just for some context setting, most of the crew that's joining us today knows EDF really well and doesn't know EDF Action, but EDF Action is the sister organization to EDF. And we can do a couple things that EDF can't do, and one of those is play politics the way you sort of see it play out in on your TVs and in your communities. We can advocate directly for or against candidates, and we did that in a lot of places this cycle. Miriam, as we said earlier, we spent well over $9 million in 14 states investing in over 35 races, both in places you've heard of and have followed really closely, like Florida, very close Senate race, it's still undecided, and of course in Nevada, where Jackie Rosen unseated a climate skeptic and Dean Heller just a couple days ago, but also in places that I'm pretty sure you'd even know those positions were elected, like a water board race in Arizona. We had a big impact. Now, most of our program was federal or focused on Congress, and we spent about half of our budget on House races. It's important that we maintain the ability to sort of work across the aisle. So we did invest in a few Republicans that had we've worked with and we viewed as allies, but for the most part, invested heavily in some Democratic some races that where there was an opportunity for the Democrat to pick up the seat and for us to replace a really bad vote with a good one. So we're able to do that because EDF Action has been building an in-house political team that has worked on congressional races and presidential races in the past. So we're lucky to have that ability to do that work. Folks may not know, I actually got my start in campaign politics now 9 cycles ago back in North Carolina on an open seat congressional race. So I'm sort of rooted in this, but I will say that, and we'll get into this a little bit later, 2018 was a race on its own. A couple of examples of things that we did and where we went. For our friends joining us from New York, we played heavily in New York 22. That was the Claudia Tenney district, where Anthony Brindisi just won that seat by about 1,000 votes, which shows you how close a lot of these races came down to. We also played out in California, for those of us joining from the West Coast, in a race in Orange County in California 48. That's the Dana Rohrabacher district. And at least last time I refreshed my browser, which I think was for the 180th time 2 minutes ago, the Democrat there was up by just about 2,000 votes. Again, incredibly close race. Yes. All in all, we had a pretty good night last night, where 2 of the 3 Republicans that we backed won re-election, and at least on the federal side, 13 of the 15 Democrats that we supported also won. So a lot of progress last night in places that really do matter.
That's fantastic. Congratulations, Linda. From your perspective, what messages, particularly environmental messages, proved most compelling? What accounted for that success?
Well, the truth is the top messages that motivated voters to go to the polls and guided their decision making once they were in the ballot box were not environmental specifically. They were in this order: healthcare, immigration, the economy, and gun policy. But the first and the third top issues you can certainly see related to environmental policy. And in fact, it's how we talk to a lot of the candidates that were running who wanted to be champions on climate. But if you were to talk about it, you could talk about the impact on healthcare. You could talk about the impact on the local economy and jobs that are available and those sorts of things. So there's a certain level of relation to this particular issue area, but the bigger picture takeaway is that voters were particularly motivated by issues. That was true at the national level, but it was also true in every race, whether you're talking about statewide or legislature level or even local. People cared about what an individual candidate was going to be able to do on a particular slate of issues that mattered to them.
That's great. So it's not a personality thing. People were really paying attention, it sounds like. Well, so Joe, you tallied some of our wins. What are the five you're most excited about, and what are the losses that you're most heartsick about?
You know, I'll start with two surprises that on election night looked like losses, and quite literally last night, when you count all the votes, ended up winning. So my Hamilton heads out there can start sort of humming and maybe changing the words a little bit. You got to count the votes. When it was all said and done, really two surprises that I'm really excited about popped through. New Jersey 3, a dynamic young candidate by the name of Andy Kim, won by just a few thousand votes in New Jersey, also my home state. Just out of the blue, and I'll sort of go into this a little bit in detail because I think it's important. In New Mexico 2, phenomenal candidate by the name of Xochitl Torres-Small pulled out a really impressive victory in New Mexico 2. New Mexico 2, I'm going to linger on it for a while, was a district that Trump carried by 10 points. Xochitl is a water rights attorney, just a high energy candidate that we were watching the whole time. She was down by what ended up being about 3,000-4,000 votes on election night, but you have to count all the votes. And when the mail-in ballots were counted and some of the provisional ballots were cleared, she won that race and by quite literally less than 2,000 votes. Just yesterday. So it's just really amazing stories like that that sort of prove why we have to engage and why we have to invest so much time and resources in playing in these places. I'll flag another one for folks. And it's right outside Philadelphia in Bucks County with one of our Republican allies, Brian Fitzpatrick, winning his reelection. In a race where both sides and the outside spending spent more than $45 million. He pulled out a win in one of the swingiest places in the country. He had the strongest environmental record of any of the Republicans running and really leaned into it to show that he was different from Trump, who had gotten very unpopular in that district. One down ballot race I want to flag for folks, actually a down ballot state, we'll say in New Mexico, was how big of a change New Mexicans are in store for. They have a dynamic new governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, that was just elected with our help, and kept a legislature that is going to help her work on issues that are really key to us or close to us, including methane and energy policy in that state. So I'm really excited about the possibility for what could happen in New Mexico on our core issues. Again, because of our ability to help candidates win these tight races. The right candidates are necessary to see policy change and progress. One sort of note I think that we should talk about is Florida and how complicated that state is. We had an ally in Carlos Curbelo lose his reelection last night by about 4,000 votes in one of the most expensive media markets and expensive races in the country down in Miami. And right now in a race too close to call, Florida Senator Bill Nelson is looking down but in a recount right now with Governor Scott, who ran against him. So really some disappointments and some races that we are still watching as we sort of move into the later parts of this week.
So Linda, let me go back to you for a minute, because Joe mentioned the role of money, but we also saw this incredible flood of engagement in politics by people who hadn't really been visible there before. We had candidates and voters of color. We had a huge vote from young people finally. So how do you make sense of that? Was it money or grassroots activism that really decided these races? And does this influx of youth mean that the future is heading our way?
Well, it's a good question, Miriam, and you know, money isn't everything, but it sure does help. And I think the big difference in 2018 over certainly past midterm cycles, but also past presidentials, was the kind of grassroots donations and grassroots engagement that we saw at unprecedented levels this go-round in 2018. In fact, the latest figure I saw from Act Blue, which is the primary means of campaigns gathering funds online through small-dollar donations, the last figure I saw was somewhere around $1.5 billion that flowed through that system to a variety of candidates in 2018. So there's no question that people were opening up their pocketbooks. There were a lot of people who were donating for the first time, not just to one candidate or two candidates, but a variety of individuals across the board that they felt like, you know, were very important to changing the dynamics in this country. There was a lot that was reported about Beto O'Rourke, for example, and the overall $70 million haul that he was able to bring in as part of his campaign. He ended up losing by just over 2%, which was the last figure that I saw. But in Texas, for a Democrat, that was pretty tremendous. And there's no question that that was related to both the level of interest among young people and communities of color, but also the grassroots donations and support that he saw. So I think in general, too, when you look at the rest of the map, across the board, we saw increases among young voters and among African-American voters and Hispanic voters that varied from, you know, over 100% over the last midterm election to as much as more than 400% over the last midterm election. So there's definitely been a dramatic shift. And I think regardless of how the individual race turned out, and in all of those cases, you know, I often say, and my colleagues often say, that voting is a habit. And so having brought all these new people into the democratic process having small d democracy bolstered by that participation is something that's going to have lasting implications for a whole host of issues moving forward.
Well, that's great. We needed a little infusion of life into democracy. Joe, I'm going to come back to you with one last question, but before I do that, we're going to turn to the audience soon. So I want to remind you that if you want to ask a question, press star 1 to get online, or you can email us at edfengage@edf.org. So, Joe, I kind of want to think about what happens next here. I want to ask you to reflect on what happens next, where the next big fights are, what the prognosis is for the issues we care about most, for climate and chemical safety and the EPA. One of our emailers asked a question. Celia Barber asked what our members and our supporters can do now, and concerned citizens, where they can move all of that energy they've been putting into this race, where they can take that energy now. So look forward a little bit for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, folks do not have a lot of time to take naps or vacations, so get that out of the way. I expect everybody to take, you know, like an hour and a half for Thanksgiving, but that's it. We get people back and working. You know, we are going to sort of start January of 2019, and everyone's going to wonder what's next. And we have a role, and I think we have to press that role of deciding what that is. And that is going to be our supporters, our members, people closest to us that are talking to new members of Congress, new governors, new state legislatures, talking about our issues, because many of them come in without a strong background in environmental policy. So we have a job to do straight away to get in front of many of these new policymakers and talk to them and make sure that they know that EDF and EDF Action are a resource for them as they form their thinking on a range of issues. I think it's a really important thing that we have to know, we have to go do straight away. We also have to be ready to use the new levers of power that we found in some states to push progressive policy. And that is not going to happen unless the constituents of New Mexico and California and New York and Colorado, all places where those states had really strong evenings last night of putting the right people in place to move progressive policy, progressive environmental policy. We have to make sure that our folks are pointed at those state legislatures and those governors to move the ball forward. And then we also have to have an organization-wide push at the sort of new levers of power that we have and should work with in Congress. The ability for some of our allies that have been waiting for gavels or waiting for subpoena power also need to hear from us, and we need to help them figure out where to push. My example of this is Scott Pruitt. This crew knows that we, on both organizations, worked really, really hard to make sure that Scott Pruitt couldn't sneeze without people knowing what he was doing, because he was doing some really bad stuff. Scott Pruitt was undone by people like you and me pushing every day, and also really enterprising reporters that would not let up. Otherwise, Scott Pruitt is still very much an EPA administrator. Now, let's think about what that was. That was public pressure. That was uncovering some of the policies that he was pushing in the EPA, and uncovering some of the malfeasance that I think really did end up being his downfall. But now, with the subpoena power, now the ability for many Democrats that care about these issues passionately to call hearings, to call witnesses, we have to leverage that new power and do a very similar thing across the administration that is working every day against the issues that and the policies and the goals that we have set for this organization. So that's the job ahead of us. Again, NAPNOW 2019 is right around the corner, and that, of course, is me being very nice, because 2020 and some really key races start yesterday.
Nice. Well, I'm glad to know that we will have some more levers to be pulling on in the coming year. One last reminder that if you want to ask a question, you can press *1 to get online, or you can email us at edfengage@edf.org. Operator, we're going to start taking questions from callers. Could you give us the first call, please?
Absolutely. Our first question today comes from Michael Bills. Your line is now open.
Well, Joe, you missed an opportunity, as when someone asked what to do. Virginia votes every year, and we will have a state legislature, 51-49 Republican now, big pickups in 17 and some hope for the country. And we're starting on that race. I am meeting with a group today. We're starting something called Clean Virginia, which is my effort toward that. But there's going to be a lot of energy in that race, and we can use all the help we can get.
Michael, really important point. And my home state, I worked my race election morning, and people are fired up in Virginia. But you're right, 2019, we have elections in Virginia. 2019, we have elections in Louisiana, so you don't have to wait until 2020 to get engaged in some key races. Really important point.
Thank you so much for that question. And anyone else who has homework assignments for Joe, feel free to call in. Operator, can we take the next question on the phone, please?
Our next question comes from Michael Zelnicker. Your line is now open.
What specific legislative policies is EDF trying to promote right now? Like, for instance, with CCL, they have their carbon fee and dividend proposal that they're working their way through various areas to try and legislate and pass. What specific proposal, the IPCC report is so alarming that clearly really dramatic legislative action has to be taken. So what specific EDF policies are you now promoting?
Joe, I'll let you take that one.
Absolutely. I'm a little bit unprepared for that one, given that I focus primarily on the political side, but I'll take a cut. And Miriam, if there's anyone, if there's any EDF staff that are lurking and we can pull in, happy to do that too. But a great question. I'll come back to climate, but I will spend just a bit of time talking about the implementation and the work that we have going on in Congress and with the administration to implement the Lautenberg Act, the Chemical Safety Act. That is something we have been working on for a number of years to make sure that the implementation of that new law is done right. The administration has not been strong on that. So now we again have the ability to influence the appointment of an administrator for that department. That is coming up right now, and I know the team is working to push the new incoming chemicals administrator to be smart and implement the law in the appropriate way. And of course, we are working with Congress to make sure that we have lawmakers that are pushing the EPA to do the same. But back to climate, because that is where that question comes, and you're exactly right. The IPCC report is a wake-up call and an important one. The EDF is working with our allies in the community to set up a push in 2019 that is community-wide and begins to allow climate advocates and allies to coalesce around a concept or sort of a shell bill. So expect that to be a early push in 2019 for us and allies. And as we move forward, and as it becomes clear that there is a space for policy to be debated, to be discussed, EDF and the team will expand upon that concept and that effort.
Right, because I'm the chairperson for the LA chapter for the Climate Reality Project, Al Gore's organization. And one of the things I'm trying to do, as I'm just newly elected, is to find out where other environmental organizations are on the kind of dramatic legislative change that we have to promote. Even as we don't have legislators, certainly we don't have anyone in the executive branch today who's going to support any of our efforts, we don't have time right now to waste. And we have to be really outspoken about the kinds of changes that have to be taken really quickly. So if there's anybody with the EDF that, you know, I might speak with offline about these issues, I'd be really happy to do that.
Fantastic. Let's make that a to-do and connect with me directly, and we will connect, and I'll connect you with the team here working on those issues. Thank you for flagging it.
Sure. Thank you.
Great. Thank you again. Operator, can we have the next question, please?
Our next question comes from Georgia Way. Your line is now open.
Hi. So there are a number of ballot initiatives that focused on the environment this year, including one in Washington, in the state of Washington, and a few in Colorado. And I was wondering if you could speak to whether EDF was involved in these and what is your take on the outcomes?
So, Joe, again, I'll let you jump in here, but Linda, please chime in if you have anything to add.
Absolutely. I know a little bit more about the Washington State effort and can speak to it. EDF Action supported the Yes on 1631 effort, and that, of course, was a disappointment on election night. A couple thoughts on what we think happened in Washington State. When that effort public support for the effort was sitting at around 60% or more, but in the very last few weeks and months, the oil and gas industry pumped more than $30 million that at least was reported to really sort of pull that initiative down, the support for the initiative down, and it did so in a way that really sort of messed with an untrue attack on that issue. So again, I think it's a reminder of how these fights play out. They are not necessarily fair or easy, but a disappointment nonetheless. I am not close to the work that went into some of the fights on the ballot in Colorado. So just for the sake of not misspeaking, I have to sort of pass on that one.
Okay, well, thank you, Joe. I want to remind listeners that if you want to ask a question, you can press star 1 to get into the queue. And the next question actually comes to us from via email from Matthew Bernard, who asks whether groups like EDF and Sierra Club can actually join forces to speak with one voice so no one of us dilutes our impact. Joe, I know that we had a huge sweep of partners in this election cycle. Can you tell us a little bit about how we did try to come together and join forces and build our impact?
It's a great question, and one that I think we have to sort of keep our focus on the fact that the green community is large, and we have allies outside of the green community we can work with all on this work. In the political side of things, the National LCV and a number of state leagues are really core important partners for us and how we leverage the resources we both groups have to yield political power. So we more than half of the races that EDF Action invested in, LCV also invested in, and that was a fantastic partnership. In the case of New Jersey 3, where we sort of just found out that Andy Kim won last night, EDF Action was on TV for 10 days, LCV, Victory Fund was on TV for 10 days, Clean Water Action and Environment America were organizing on the ground in that district, a really great example of the green community working together to leverage each other's strengths and build political power. But there are really great examples of some of these collaborations in states and for down ballot work that I think really set up for legislative wins or certainly policy pushes in key states. One of those examples is in Arizona, where we work with partners on the ground to influence a water board in Maricopa County, as well as a few key state legislative races. The work with those in-state partners, as well as the in-state lead conservation voters, allowed us to win preferred candidates of five of the five seats on that water board that were up last night. In the state legislature, we were able to back the presumptive incoming Republican Speaker of the House. We thought that he would be the strongest legislator for our work on water issues in that state, in that region. We supported him, and we are happy that he won, and again, looks like he has a shot at being Speaker of the Arizona legislature. Just an example of some of the partnerships that really set us up to do some state-level legislative activity and make progress in the state. Another one of those states is in North Carolina, where we invested in Republicans and Democrats running for the state House and state Senate. Our hope there is to give the Governor Cooper, who has turned into one of the leading voices for energy and environmental issues in the Southeast, a few more allies to work with in the state legislature. And then, of course, in Colorado, where so much of our work and our state policy work has seen a lot of success, especially on methane regulation in that state. We invested heavily in the state House and state Senate races there to give a dynamic new governor in Jared Polis the legislature that he will need to push environmental progress in Colorado. So just a few examples of places where we invested alongside partners. None of that work was just us going alone, a gunslinger in the desert. It is all done and leveraged heavily with some of the best and brightest in these key places.
Well, and it's great that it not only was so effective in the election itself, but will have this enduring impact. That's really heartening. Operator, could we please have the next question from the phone, please?
Our next question comes from Jerome Ringo. Your line is now open.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to be on the call. I live down in Louisiana along the coast, and I noticed that throughout this campaign cycle, many of the candidates on both sides of the aisle were making coastal restoration a priority issue. Even though over the years past, climate change has not been a priority issue with most of these candidates, you rarely hear a discussion about climate change in the debates or in the campaigns. But this year, coastal restoration was a real issue. Will EDF, or has EDF partnered with some of the coastal restoration groups, not just in Louisiana, but along the Gulf Coast, that have been so adversely impacted by the intense hurricanes, which is directly tied to climate change, and use the coastal restoration issue sort of as the Trojan horse that gets opens up a discussion that might eventually lead to climate change?
No, I'm afraid it's to you again.
It's quite all right, Miriam. Everyone's getting their money's worth. It's good to hear my friend Jerome, and it's good to hear your voice. It's getting cold here, Jerome. I'm going to come visit you and get some of the warm weather down in Louisiana soon. A really fantastic question, and I'm going to at least suggest that the groups that we've worked with on the ground in places like Louisiana are not tip of my tongue, but Steve Cochran, who leads our work in the Mississippi River Delta Gulf out of Louisiana, is really an expert, and I do want to make sure that you get a chance to connect with him and him answer that question appropriately. I will say, though, that this election cycle, we did see the issue of climate change and coastal issues be really, really important to voters. And you don't have to go far and take the highway over to Florida to see how important the issue of red tide was in that Senate race. It is one that that had such political salience that that we, EDF Action, and LCV Victory Fund made it a part of our closing argument in that Senate race. It is something that was on everyone's brains, and although Florida is a big, expensive state to play politics in, we felt it necessary to jump in there and use and talk about red tide and environmental impacts in that Senate race. There are a couple other things that popped up around the country that I think are worth noting. In California, you saw candidates out there talking about the California wildfires and directly talking about climate change. That is just fundamentally different than anything I've seen in the past, especially since it's just sort of easy to talk about wildfires. The candidates took a step further and connected to climate change. I had never seen that before. And to be fair, I'm sure there are people running in very, very safe Democratic districts that did this prior, but I have never seen it in really competitive districts in the past. So just an example of climate sort of becoming a tangible environmental issue and one that that candidates really embraced. You saw, candidates that have been talking about environmental issues forever and sometimes in a not positive way. Ann Kirkpatrick running in Arizona was one of the Democratic votes against cap and trade in 2009-2010. She aggressively pushed climate change on the campaign trail in her run to be reelected to state to the House. That is just, it shows a sort of sea change, pun almost certainly intended, that we're seeing in politics on this issue. So if I can sort of wrap by saying I do want to make sure that Steve gets a chance to answer that question fully for you directly because I think it's an important one, but I didn't want the opportunity to go by without at least suggesting that climate really did play a significant part in a number of races this year.
Well, that's a great segue to the next question, which I will read from email. But before I do that, I want to remind everyone that you can get into the queue by pressing star one, or you can email us at edfengage@edf.org. So this next question comes from Chris Wilson, and it's really looking a little bit a longer view all the way up to these next 2 years between now and 2020 and what the prospects are for being able to do big action on climate or our other issues, or are we really going to have to settle for incremental change until we get a new president? Linda, you want to take a first crack at that one?
Well, let me just pull out my crystal ball here and see if I can figure out what the answer is. You know, honestly, I don't know. I mean, I feel like the level of activism that we've seen from people of all ages since the beginning of this administration is certainly unprecedented. I mean, I often think of that as the silver lining of the world that we find ourselves in. I saw a statistic that 1 in 5 Americans had participated in some sort of protest action from between 2016 and the earlier part of this year, and that was before the March for Our Lives, before the family separation crisis, and a good portion of those, 1 in 5 of those who had participated in protests, had never done it before. So there's something happening where people feel like they can't take our democracy for granted, they can't take safeguarding issues like climate, and of course we all saw the climate march as well, they can't take any of these issues for granted, and not only that, they're willing to fight, even if it's by taking it to the streets in order to make clear where they stand on things. And, you know, where there's been a big enough furor, the family separation crisis is actually a really good example of that. It has forced even this administration to change the way that it is approaching a particular issue. So I imagine that if there is some coalescing among the groups around a particular initiative, I know Joe was talking about potential shell legislation, if there is a coordinated push, there certainly seems like there is the potential to organize people in a way that they essentially create a crisis that the administration can't ignore. The last thing I would say is some of the things that I have found most inspiring and life-giving and hopeful about all of the activities that we've seen over the past year is this effort called This Is Zero Hour, which was started by a number of high schoolers who are specifically concerned, as folks may know, about the inaction on the environment and what kind of planet is going to be left to them to clean up. And so they've taken it upon themselves to rally people of their own age and their own ilk to understand the issues, to get information out into their communities, and then organize their own activities around it. So there's a lot of potential, and I think that I wouldn't be surprised if there were some sort of significant action between now and 2020.
That's great. Joe, you wanna address whether that might include a carbon price? Did the loss of Curbelo and Love hurt us on that front, or do you think there's any chance we might move that?
Yeah, I think that's there's a couple layers to that. I think it's unlikely, and I think we've talked about this a bit earlier that this president would sign a bill establishing a carbon price. So let's just sort of put that aside. So looking ahead into 2021, when things get normal, we have the ability to ramp to that that opportunity, and there's a lot of things that I think go into that. One is making sure that there continues to be a call for climate action from Republicans. And Congressman Curbelo losing in Florida, in my opinion, does not change the trajectory of where we see Republican support going on this issue. I'll sort of remind folks that EDF and EDF Action have been working since 2014 on this exact point when Chris Gibson was the first Republican member of Congress to step out and want to lead on climate. He retired, And when he retired, there was a young guy that no one had heard of before, named Carlos Curbelo, that wanted to step into that role. Congressman Curbelo losing on Tuesday hurts, but does not mean that that's the Republican leadership is dead. We very much expect, and maybe I'm sort of being too aggressive and glass half full here, but we expect that there will be members of the House that want to step into that role because of what it did for Congressman Curbelo. And let me sort of lay that out. I think it's really important to fully understand how important that issue was for him and his politics. And that sounds like that I'm suggesting that he only did for his politics. He did not. There are easier ways to sort of check boxes than what the congressman did to write a bill and put it out there for everyone to shoot at. What he was able to do, though, is he was able to connect with voters on an issue they deeply care about. That district in South Miami only talked about, not only, but for the most part, had millions of dollars of advertising in the last week of that campaign on the environment. You had two candidates duking it out to see of who was better on environmental issues. I've never seen that before. But it, again, sort of cuts to how important being a leader on climate and the environment was for Congressman Curbelo's support. And in this case, the Democrat running against him had to make it an issue. I can think of sort of no better example of how what we want to see across the country, these contests of people duking it out on an issue and of who's better, who's stronger. But again, to sort of wrap it up, Miriam, I very much expect that there will be leaders in the House, maybe in the Senate, that want to sort of continue this work, and we will be there working right alongside them to help them get there.
Okay, one last reminder to everybody. We have a few minutes left, so if you have a question you're still burning to ask, get into the queue by pressing star 1. And operator, could we go to the phone, please, for the next question?
Our next question comes from Molly McPherson. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to ask a question about how the new congressional makeup is going to impact Andrew Wheeler at EPA.
All right. Who wants to take that one? Joe, you want to start?
I'm going to take that because I alluded to Mr. Pruitt, so let's talk about Mr. Wheeler. I think that Andy Wheeler is going to get tired of walking down Independence Avenue to the Capitol to talk to Congress, and I think that's a very good thing on a range of issues. We've sort of always said that no matter how dysfunctional the Trump administration is, they somehow managed to put people that were very good at their job in EPA and DOE. So that was an unfortunate truth for our issues, because those people very much wanted to work against things that EDF has been pushing for decades. But now with the new makeup of Congress and some of the really smart and engaged lawmakers in the House, that there's an opportunity for them to have Andy Wheeler and his team in Rayburn, in Energy and Commerce, and talking to members of Congress about what they're doing, and holding the administration accountable for policies that that people don't want and certainly don't know are happening. I think that's a real positive of the change last night, and we should expect that, and we should help those lawmakers do that work and hold EPA accountable.
Well, and we also know that Congressman Elijah Cummings is going to be, and he's been very, very clear that he wants to see a lot more paper from this administration, and that is across the board, whether that's the White House or it's the cabinet agencies. And as we all know, the administrator at EPA has not been particularly forthcoming or shared a lot of details about his lobbying past, and so that is certainly an area that we can anticipate that the new majority in Congress is going to want more information about potential conflicts of interest, whether they're ongoing or could influence the way that he runs the agency now.
Great. So we know that our goals are to have candidates competing over which one of them is greener, and we want members of this administration to be physically fit from the walk to Capitol Hill. So two goals for the coming year. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thank you, Joe and Linda, for shedding so much light here. And we look forward to convening all again for the next session of EDF Engage. Thank you.